This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Studies of the American West, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. William L. Burr Jr. is a curator emeritus of the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institution. And I'm delighted to be with him here today to talk about his new book, In the Arms of Saguaros, Iconography of the Giant Cactus, published by the University of Arizona Press. I've read the book. It's fascinating, and it's also beautifully illustrated. In the book, William Byrd explains how the saguaro cactus became a beloved icon and a meme for the American West that we now take for granted in art and interior design and advertising and film. And I'm very much looking forward to our conversation about this. So welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Dan.
So let's start with the obvious question I imagine you were asked. It was one that people asked me when I told them what I was reading. Why a book about a cactus, and actually a book about one species of cactus?
Well, the book is about how the saguaro became the thing that you think about when you think about the American West. And so the story starts with botanical exploration and discovery and the role that the plant, you know, continues to play as an icon of the West. And by iconography, I mean the pictures that you've been carrying around in your head, you know, since you were a little kid, and that you can add to anywhere, anytime, and even subtract things. And when I began this project, I would ask people, where do you get your ideas about, you know, this particular cactus? And someone would say, well, I could tell how old they were. You know, they would say the Roadrunner. You know, the lunchbox I carried, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, we've all seen them almost to the point that it's almost like a kind of a literal wallpaper in the current moment in which we are now, when viral images are just all around us. But there was a time when there was a conscious, strategy that was adopted by tourism and travel people in the Southwest to, you know, turn this thing into a symbol and into an icon.
That's great, because ever since I read the book, there's a thing in psychology, I forgot what it's called, where I've started to see saguaros even more often popping up on things. Like it seems like they're everywhere now. Let's take a step back. What
Most
exactly
often where they shouldn't actually be?
Yes, exactly. Which is also part of the book, right? Let's take a step back. What is a saguaro, and where are they found?
The saguaro is a columnar. A cactus with spines. It has a super long lifespan, anywhere from 150 to 200 years. They all start out as columns or columnar plants. And when they get to be a certain age, say between, well, people think about this differently, around 50 years old, they potentially can grow arms. They begin to grow arms. And that's the icon. In fact, I'm looking at something now that it's like a pillow across the room in my house. And they typically have, you know, two, three, four. I mean, they can have nine. They can have multiple arms. And they have this a kind of a peculiar anthropomorphic quality. And when you see them for real, I mean, in the desert, not in a hothouse or a botanical garden, the impression is one of, you know, they're almost waving at you. They have that kind of a human quality to them. But that's what they are. And every, you know, May, June, they flower and fruit. And the fruit is the kind of the life-saving or life-giving element of the Sonoran Desert, which enabled people to survive for, you know, years with the fruit of this plant, which could also be made into a wine. But it's typically something that can be, you know, processed rolled out and preserved. So that's basically what it is.
And they're found primarily in Arizona and in like northwest Mexico and a little bit in California, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The habitat stretches, well, it's exclusively in the Sonoran Desert, which about two-thirds of it is in Mexico and a third of it is in Arizona. But the habitat is almost 50-50 in Arizona and Mexico, maybe a little more. It goes all the way down to Guaymas and as far north in Arizona as Kingman. But the Phoenix metropolitan area, the Tucson metropolitan area are bracketed by the plant in its native habitat.
Okay, great. So your book traces what you call it the social saguaro, and how the icon of this plant was used to advertise and kind of represent the Southwest, and how automatically it pops into our head. And your point is that, well, that wasn't, it's automatic now, but there was a whole process to it. So it seems very intuitive. You think of the Southwest, you think of this cactus, but your book shows it was that process. So I want to start at the beginning of that process and ask you about some people and events. So the first one I want to ask you about is this: who was Lieutenant William Hemsley Emery?
Well, Emery was the Army topographical engineer who was charged with exploring the flattest route to the West Coast from the Missouri Territory in the era of the Mexican War. So Emery's travels take him straight through the Gila River Valley. I mean, he starts off St. Louis, then he goes to Kansas, then he goes down to Santa Fe, and then he cuts through the Gila River Valley, which is just south of the present-day city of Phoenix. And this is saguaro land. And so his report, which is published in 1848 by the Congress of the United States, features the first published images of the plant in all of its glory. And I like looking at these early pictures of saguaros that come from these government exploring parties. I like looking at images of the plant that come from government exploring parties, whose artists typically picture it as a tree. And the finished published image would include figures of people that were introduced for scale. And however, the figures of people were often reduced in proportion to the plant, which made the plants appear to be even more massive and dramatic as scientific discoveries. And this seems to have been a kind of a conscious decision, because over a period of 10 years, Emery, it goes back out into the field. He publishes a second boundary survey after the war, and he does the same thing again with a completely different set of artists and engravers and lithographers, and the plants become even more dramatic and the figures come even more diminutive. But it really didn't matter at the time, because I mean, he got out of it what he wanted. This is, you know, scientific drama in the West writ large. And it really probably didn't really even matter, because a lot of people hadn't really seen the plants, and it didn't really become an issue until more people had seen them, when you could clearly look and, oh, that's not right.
So that's 1848. And you point out in the book how quickly the saguaro was transplanted for use in like world's fairs and collectors' greenhouses and cactus clubs. And this was something that was all brand new to me that I thought was fascinating. Can you talk about what you call the cactus craze that took hold near like the end of the 19th century?
Well, it's a, and this was sort of, I think maybe where, what the book's contribution is, and that this was new to me too. And there's a kind of a conspicuous transplantation of these plants. And it's when it starts in 1880, when the railroad comes to Tucson for the first time. And the railroad comes to Tucson from the west. So it comes from California to Tucson, and then it continues east, and then it links up with developments and things that are happening in the east. It's not the other way around, what we typically think of, you know, the uniting of the rails. And as soon as the railroad, you know, comes to the Sonoran Desert, they begin transplanting cacti saguaros back to California. And one of the big four of the Southern Pacific, a man named Charles Crocker, builds a hotel on the Monterey Peninsula, the Hotel Del Monte, and he has an Arizona garden, which includes columnar saguaros that are propped up with braces. And these things are maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 feet high, quite dramatic. And they have other plants as well, yuccas, agaves, of course, palms, an Arizona garden. And it, the thing was such a hit that his partner, Leland Stanford, ordered up one. And so Stanford had one at his home at, well, what's today's Stanford. But the most notable one was the Arizona garden sitting there near Carmel on the coast up at Monterey. And they were also placed at Union or at Southern Pacific Railroad stations. So you might first encounter one in San Antonio, you know, trackside at a station, and then you would go and, you know, 300, 350 miles, whatever, before you actually get to the Sonoran Desert, then you start to see them in the wild. And they also had them at their Los Angeles depot, which is kind of rather curious to me. I mean, there's a conceit, and there's in the book, there's a tall tale postcard, things grow large in California. And it's a kind of a gag photo of a tiny diminutive man, not unlike the first, you know, Emery engravings and lithographs. And the plant is just this huge, massive thing. It's clearly like a cut and paste job, but that's the conceit. Things grow large in California. But in Arizona, they're not sure that that's really the symbol that they want. They're trying to, well, I guess we'll get into that. But they also put them on the rails courtesy of the Southern Pacific, and they went to World's Fairs. And this was the most, well, depending on, it could be either shocking or disturbing, depending on your point of view. Where at the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, a Tucson theater owner thought it would be a great idea to populate the fairgrounds with saguaros. And so they actually, and this is the first photographic image of an armed and branched plant, massive plant. And this is something only the railroad could have done, you know, probably pulled it up trackside with a crane, probably built a framework, a structure, a padded structure around it. And then they install it at Chicago in front of the horticulture building. And it's simply described as the giant cactus. And so you see people in bowler hats, you know, walking by, posing, looking at this thing. And I mean, you understand it's a World's Fair, and it's not a permanent thing. A saguaro can cheat death for years in or out of the ground and even bloom. It can't freeze, but nonetheless, there it is. It's hard to know, I mean, what happened to that. I mean, some of them made their way into botanical, you know, hothouses and gardens in Pittsburgh, for example. They're really survivors. They're pretty resilient. I mean, they can't freeze, but they do require some protection. But I think this is how the plant began to take on a kind of an iconography, a freestanding iconography that would just show up any place. And this is the West. This is what where this came from. This is what's out there.
You mentioned earlier that originally not everyone was all, you know, all in with the saguaro. And you use a phrase to capture the ways that the early boosters of the region, they're trying to, you know, boost the region of the Southwest. But you use this great phrase about how they thought about the saguaro sometimes. And it was this, I'm going to quote you. Your quotation is, cactus is here, but can you talk about that phrase and how that kind of echoes the way some people thought about what we see as this absolute icon of the Southwest?
Well, I mean, I studied the land sales propaganda put out by the Territory of Arizona and the railroads, which seemed to emanate from the same, you know, like thinking minds. They freely distribute each other's tracts and pamphlets and that kind of thing. And these things are legion, and because you can download them, you know, easily now on the internet, you can search them pretty quickly for the word cactus or any one of the various spellings of the word saguaro, and you can see which ones don't even mention a cactus. Does this strike you odd? Is odd? And which one? And when they do, how do they describe it for their would-be audience of investors and immigrants? So it's here, but it's obviously there. How can you escape it, its sight from being there? But it might not be what you wanted to see if you're planning on developing a citrus grove or an alfalfa field or, you know, I mean, there's a picture in the book of an alfalfa field, and they didn't even bother to take the plants down. You know, they're just like farming around them. You know, to me, that is the biggest, it's so incongruous. I mean, that's what's incongruous.
Yeah.
You know,
also that it was brought, you know, like you say, to the World's Fair as the giant cactus, and it was kind of billed as almost like this botanical King Kong, this wonder of the world. But then where the things actually live, it's like, yeah, we'll just go around them.
Well, but one of the fair, well, this is really, I mean, to this point in my research and writing, these are just anecdotal. You know, there was a fair visitor from the Arizona territory who really worked himself up and took exception to seeing these plants at the fair because in the way he put it in a little letter that he wrote to the papers at the time, that the state or the territory had missed the opportunity to show off, you know, what the icon should be, which would be a statue of abundance with a capital A, with a horn of plenty in each hand instead of the withered cactus stalk, you know, presumably demonstrating the poverty of the soil, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, they actually would say that, you know, and so, I mean, that's what cactus is here, but, you know, that's what that is. That's the but.
Your book is filled with people for whom the cactus engenders, you know, or provokes very strong emotions. So I want to ask you about the names of some of these folks as we go forward in time and ask you to talk to our listeners about them. So the first is, tell everyone, who was Harold Bell Wright?
Harold Bell Wright was a romantic novelist. He's largely forgotten today, but he, in his time, the 19-teens and 20s, he was a preacher, a minister from the Midwest. And he wrote a couple of sermons, like almost a serial installment, and his parishioners begged him to publish them. And these became, you know, major, you know, successful novels, and he became rich. And moreover, he became a Hollywood filmmaker, turning his novels into pictures. And maybe the names are a little more familiar, Barbara Worth, or the mine with the iron door. And he usually would go to a place and live in it, and in a matter of a year or two would start to write something about the place and use that as a setting. And he had chronic lung issues, and he moved from Southern California to Tucson, where he worked in the sun, he lived in the sun, he moved way out of town to what would later become a guest ranch. He made a work table where he could write sitting in the sun, but the table, the writing surface would actually be shaded. And so he got better, he got well, and he ended up writing an American magazine article entitled "Why I Did Not Die."
Great title.
And this was something that, I mean, it just alloyed him to Tucson and the history of the town. And just fast forward, he buys a tract of land way outside of town in the desert. He builds a Spanish Revival house on a mesa, and he tells his construction crew, don't touch the plants. He has them landscape the driveway up to the mesa with electric lights and native plants. And when it was done, it set off a land rush among people who had also come west, many of them for their health, and also local Tucsonans who came out and said, this is really beautiful. Well, I mean, it had been there the whole time. The only thing that had changed was the introduction of this palatial home by a celebrity author, Hollywood filmmaker. And it was just off and running. People began just opening their eyes that the desert is actually can be kind of beautiful. And he certainly had the views of the mountain ranges and the bowl that is Tucson in this undisturbed setting, which is just really spectacular.
Yeah. And which is, again, like we said earlier, what's so fascinating is that we think that it would be intuitive. Like, how could that not be intuitive to know how beautiful it was? But it's almost like people had to learn that. You use the phrase at one point, I think you say, he helped frame the desert for domestic consumption.
Right. I mean, you know, that's kind of what that thought that you had about, you know, how can you not regard it as anything other than beautiful? And that's sort of like what I thought when I approached the topic, because I assumed that there was this upward arc of, you know, as you get more familiar with the plant, it becomes more popular. In other words, popularity is a function of awareness. And, you know, what's not to like? Well, you know, like that fairgoer from the Arizona territory who didn't like it at all, it is an upward curve, but it goes up and it goes down. It goes up, it's going up, but it goes back. And it's like a saw blade, which is kind of an apt metaphor for where the iconography is headed, you know, going into the turn of the century. It's cactuses here, but, and you can also see it in the artwork that became the state seal, which is still in use today, which features a miner with a shovel and a pickaxe, you know, a storage reservoir with a dam and an irrigated green field, a steer representing cattle. And there's no native botany at all in the state seal. So, you know, that, so, it, but it, this business of picturing Arizona,
right,
in this time, it all depends on who's in charge or who's in control and what particular vision they have in terms of what the iconography is going to be. You know, for some, it's an orange tree. I mean, oranges hanging, you know, and you think of Southern California has that same kind of, you know, golden glow. And we had that too in Arizona without a native plant in sight.
Right.
Many people wanted that.
Yeah. But you would think if there was going to be one spot you would start to find a saguaro, it would be the state seal of Arizona. And as you show in the book, like, nope, you keep looking.
No.
So the next person I want to ask you about is Homer Leroy Shantz.
Yeah. Professor Shantz, is an interesting figure. He's a botanist and a photographer, and he becomes the university president in 1928, and he has a pretty good tenure to that 1936. So 28 to 36 are his years with the stock market crash and the depression. And the saguaro forest that would be to the east of Wright's property, which is today's current Saguaro National Park, Saguaro East, would have been, you know, accessible to him and to others who would go out there. And when you joined the faculty of the university or you came to Tucson as a person of means, you were often taken to this tract of saguaros, these, you know, ancient, you know, core specimens. And it was just like this awesome thing. And Chance, as a botanist, spent a lot of time out there. We know that because his photo collection, his glass plate negatives, all have dates etched into the margin. And he's out there with another botanist friend, a man named R.B. Streets. They go out there almost every, you know, holiday weekend. So he spends a lot of, you know, George Washington birthday weekends out there taking pictures. And a lot of what we know about that track that is now the national park comes from Chance's photos, particularly that stand of mature saguaros that is really no longer with us. I mean, there of course are others, but he was also responsible for developing the University of Arizona's campus cactus garden as a kind of a dreamy landscape that was set in a water collecting arroyo right in the heart of the campus to the east of the what's now the old main building. But it's still this back and forth kind of thing. You know, what should the campus look like? I mean, people come from elsewhere and they want Bermuda grass and, you know, flood irrigation. And after Chance left, the campus, the cactus garden arroyo was filled in. And it's now just trees and lawns with vistas of buildings, which is pretty much what you see today. But for some, though, that was the vision all along. And there is still a small little remnant footprint of that cactus garden it sits out as an island in the middle of this long green sward.
So to go back to your idea back about the saguaro back and forth, you think it's fair to say like the saguaro is kind of going, the story is going from like a decoration on the edge of an image of the Southwest, kind of like towards the center, it gets closer to the center, push back a little, gets closer to the center.
Right. That literally happens. It's the travel and tourism industry that take this thing and spin it into the icon that you think about today. I collected a lot of contemporary travel brochures, and one thing I like about them, I mean, as a student of advertising, is they don't really use photos that much. They use the techniques of commercial illustration, which give things a kind of a more, I don't know, there's just a kind of a warmth. And you can get exactly the effect that you want from an illustration. And so there are brochures that show you on the front of the cover, which if you opened it, it would be to the right of the fold, okay, the kind of longitudinal fold. There will be a woman dressed as a cowgirl picking or fondling an orange, you know, on a tree, and you can see the grove laid out, you know, to the horizon. And then when you flip the brochure over, you see, hey, there's an armed saguaro that's on the periphery of the edge. You know, it's not in the center of the fold. It's not what you see. And then later you see where they just go for it. They put, you know, horseback riders, and there's a saguaro, and it's flowering, and maybe there's a yucca on the spine. And they've totally gone, you know, to the horse, the rider, and then later on the swimming pool, you know, everything. But yeah, there will be a cactus. There will be a saguaro. And this is a function of travel and tourism. I mean, they care about irrigation, of course. They care about, you know, people, you know, being able to sustain themselves and have a livelihood and all of that stuff. But data botany is now ascendant in their literature. And you can look and you'll find postcards of the way rooms are decorated and laid out, where they'll have a bedspread with, you know, saguaro themes. And so, I mean, you're starting to not, you can't get close enough to the plant now. You know, you can wrap up with it, you know, get comfortable with it, get cozy with it. You can even sleep with it in this literature. So that's how it kind of gets set up. And, I guess if they had been making the state seal after the Second World War, or maybe on the eve of the war, they might not have been able to get away without putting an armed, you know, saguaro in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Sleeping with Saguaros. That would be a great title for a Western, wouldn't it? A dime novel.
Well, In Your Arms, I was surprised. You know, I mean, I researched that phrase. I typed it,
really?
It's easy enough to do, and no one had used it. I was
Really?
stunned. No, try it.
Yeah,
okay. I mean, even as a subtitle, it had never been used. I just don't know why. I guess maybe I just parachuted into Tucson, you know. I mean, I went to school here a long time ago, but I came back, and this is really the book that I wanted to check out of the library and read, you know.
So I
just did it.
Well, you point out one way to gauge, so we talk about advertising, right? Another way to gauge the strength of the saguaro as an icon was, and this again, all new to me and all so much fun to learn about. You talk about the proliferation of what you call cactus gags. And you talk about, I thought this was hilarious, the Sunshiners Modeling Club at Tucson High School in 1949. So talk about what cactus gags were, and especially the Sunshiners Modeling Club.
Well, this is where... I guess the denouement of the book is, you know, where it comes together with these photos. But they really have a kind, it's an advertising story. There was an organization prepared in 1922. The city fathers of Tucson, after the census of 1920, realized that the population of Tucson had gone, it was now Phoenix was more populous population. And so they formed a group aside from the Chamber of Commerce, which was a political group, to solely promote the city as a winter destination. So they developed a community advertising campaign with a Los Angeles advertising agency who told them the only thing you have to sell is sunshine. And so it became the Sunshine Climate Club. And so the Sunshine Climate Club funded a national advertising campaign in these high-class magazines and also newspapers, in which it really wasn't heavy on illustration. There were no cactus pictures, but there was a little coupon at the end for you to clip out and send in for a free booklet that, again, did not picture a cactus on the cover, but showed you, you know, it could be Tucson, any town, USA. Once you opened it up, you did see pictures of saguaros, but that really wasn't the come on. And I mean, this was a Los Angeles advertising agency. And in quick order, Phoenix hired the same agency. And so you now have these two almost identical Southern Arizona campaigns being run by a Los Angeles ad agency. And the agency, it was the McCann agency, later became McCann Erickson, but it's the McCann agency. They kept careful records and they could show the city fathers of Tucson who were spending their money on this campaign that people actually, once they had their name and address that they collected from the coupons, they could follow them. And some of them had actually moved to Tucson and bought homes. So this was an incredible campaign. But in the Depression, it began to drop off and people in town were reluctant to fund it and they began to drop out. So at the end of the 30s, a couple of men get together and they decide that they could do a good job of taking what we will now call viral photographs that would recommend themselves to the nation's editors and newspapers that they could place for free. And so they chose to make a photograph of a woman's sunsuit that was made out of saguaro ribs or saguaro, the growth tips of the thing. It looks like a bikini, a very thorny bikini. And this went in, it was a huge hit, 300 newspapers, Life magazine came calling for the story. But the thing was kind of off-putting. And it became apparent to them that they liked the idea of not paying for advertising. They enjoyed, you know, cutting up plant parts and all that stuff. But it was easier to pose models, scantily clad models, young high school students sitting on the plants or leaning on them or, you know, barefoot and, you know, with pads and all that sort of thing. And they didn't use the word viral. They called them gag photos. cactus gags. And so this was how they began to promote the Southwest, with these bathing suit models posed on the arms, literally in the arms of saguaros. And that was kind of how I started out, because I saw one of these magazine covers from, you know, 1950. It's in black and white. And I picked it up and I looked at it, go, wow, the woman, she's folding her arms and she's on the arm. Her folded arms are on the arm that should have spines, but it apparently the spines had worn off. Maybe it suffered from loads of attention. It's hard to know, but it's something that you, even if you don't understand what the plant is, you cannot not look at it. You keep turning back and looking at it. So that kind of pose, it did its job. But I think it's also a turning point where people, you know, they're starting to understand the environmental consequences of the desert in the way that it's framed up. You know, when you introduce people into it, it becomes a social thing, a social occasion. So that's where the idea of the social saguaro comes from. And it's usually in the company of freshly starched Western wear, swimming pools, bathing suits, chuck wagons, and sometimes campfires, and sometimes they're all in the same picture.
Yeah, they are. You point out that those gag photos and the Sunshine Modeling Club, you say, you know, that was the beginning when people started to appreciate, and I love this phrase, the fragility of nature's sharpest curves.
Right. That, yes.
Yeah. So well said. So I have to emphasize, I want to change tack for a second and emphasize to our listeners that this is a physically beautiful book. This book is a beautiful object in its own right. There are color pictures on every page. They're really key to the text so well. It was such a nice feeling to read it, and then figure 7, figure 8. And you flip around, you see what you're talking about. I felt like I was in a museum of saguaros, the saguaro museum with you. And you were kind of like walking me through and say, okay, now take a look at this and here's what this means. So I want to ask you about your the way you collated all these images. And I know some of these, when I looked at the credits, are from your own collections, right? So was going through the images how you learned about the saguaro and what you wanted to write about? Or did you have a lot of it written and then you kind of found images to support that? Like, were you inductive or deductive in your saguaro narrative?
Inductive and deductive. Well, I was trained as a historian, but I worked in a museum. And so everything there was from the object out. You know, I mean, you have to take a lesson from the art historians, really. I mean, I worked at the National Museum of American History, and most of my projects began with something interesting to look at. And then what is that story? I mean, just to give you some more relatable example, I once curated an exhibit. It was American television. And the last thing you saw was a wall of metal embossed lunchboxes, you know, kids' character lunchboxes. And the label in the middle, you know, was like, well, you've seen, you know, television, you've seen all this, but in the end, television, it's the pictures in your head. Okay. Now, I could miss with that label. You can agree with that. You can disagree with that. But at least you saw something interesting to look at that might beg another question. But that was the question, or that was the statement that I wished to make. It's the pictures in your head. So there's kind of a link between that and like all of my projects. I mean, I began this one, you know, probably just didn't even think about it as a book until maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. But I found the magazine I was describing with the Western wear model, the guest ranch model with her arms folded in a saguaro. I mean, she's literally framed by the plant. And that I got the title from that, you know, I got the subtitle. I mean, that was set me off. And then it turns out that the Arizona Historical Society here, the Tucson branch, has the records of the Sunshine Climate Club from the 20s. It went up into the 60s. And there are hundreds of those photos that they took. They might not have used them all. They couldn't have used them all. And I realized this is a conscious strategy. This isn't like a one-off. you know, hit or miss. There's like some thought that went into this. And it's really interesting when you you find people like that who they themselves are making things that they believe are inherently interesting to look at, think about, that will generate interest and cause conversation. And they were ad men, as men. And most of the photographers were men. There are a few women, of course, but it's mostly men, and they were doing the job. So it is like a small exhibit. But it's object. It's definitely object out. I mean, I try not to write. I mean, I don't know. I could go on, but
it's all good. It's interesting. I was going to say, you talked about ad men, which of course, half the time I read the book, I thought of Mad Men and, you know, Don Draper and his staff. How are we going to sell and market the desert? And at one point it occurred to me that, well, the success of that campaign and what they did with the saguaro is I'm proof of that, because I'm sitting in New Jersey right now. And all of my images of Arizona are from films and but Wile E. Coyote and the things I've seen in your book. So it's kind of like I'm proof that they're like, yeah, we got that guy. So let's go to our present day. You say towards the end of your book, you say that the saguaro is now having a moment, and you look at our present moment. So how would you describe the moment that the saguaro is having?
Well, again, it enjoys success as part of this toolkit of symbols and memorable associations of pictures, images, and things that you carry around in your head. And we talked about it, you know, before. I mean, the Western wear, the horseback rides, the campfires, the cookouts, the swimming pools, the bathing suits. It's part of this toolkit, this package that had been developed, and it's basically a vocabulary of kind of the fun in the sun sales message that took root, you know, in the Southwest, but then it also expanded out into the popular imagination onto the American roadside. And this, you know, there's a creative habitat of, you know, neon signs. It's on placemats in Texas. You know, it's on roadmaps, cartoons. And though this commercial habitat is completely imaginary, it's still very powerful. In fact, it may be more powerful. It overpowers the actual habitat itself. And this is pretty much where we are today in fashion and art. So
that's our moment, right? I also did a little research on my own when I knew I was going to speak to you to see, well, how much of a big deal is the cactus craze now all over the country? Because you mentioned like Leland Stanford and you know the Arizona Gardens, and this was all news to me. How zealous collectors are today, and how it's become something like comic books or baseball cards or works of art, where you go on these websites and you can order cacti from all over the world shipped to your door, and people are still trying to recreate these gardens no matter where they live.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, to me, it's kind of oddly transforming. And even the smallest plant can suggest a larger plant. I mean, in the late 19th century, plants, saguaros were being sold, little tiny, you know, diminutive things. And the people who were selling them were criticized, because what's the likelihood that that's ever going to achieve, you know, maturity within your lifetime? Probably not. But yet, among a certain class of people, it was a kind of a conspicuous, you know, consumption or conspicuous transplantation kind of thing. But today, you can have, you know, something on your windowsill that can evoke a memory and an image and a picture that you paint for yourself, or that it paints for you. And I think that that's a very transportable and a pleasant kind of thing to have, an association. But it's more tough with a saguaro, because it has to be grown from a seed. You know, it cannot be grown from a cutting. I mean, many people don't know that. Most of the articulated plants that you see are made that way, so that they can drop off or be carried off on an animal coat or something and drop somewhere. And whenever they make contact with the ground or it gets dark, They can grow a whole, they can just completely regenerate themselves from a cutting. But that's impossible with a saguaro, which I think keeps it that special thing. And oftentimes in, you know, decorator magazines and things, you'll see a there's a kind of a Peruvian a columnar series, well, series is like a column torch, and they'll trim it into the shape of a saguaro, you know, so it has, you're still seeing this thing, this ersatz thing in the corner, propped up in the corner with little arms coming out of it. You know, it's really trying, but you just look at that. If you know what you're looking at, you go, decor.
In the Arms of Saguaros, Iconography of the Giant Cactus is published by the University of Arizona Press. It's available everywhere. It's a beautiful and a beautifully written book. I thank you so much, William L. Byrd. Thank you for talking to our listeners about this great work.
Thanks, Dan.